You're about to hear a forum on fracking in Idaho held at the Hamilton Indoor Recreation Center in Moscow, Saturday, February 11th. Panelists include University of Idaho hydrogeologist Jerry Fairley, Kai Huschke of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, Southern Idaho fracking activists Amanda Buchanan and Liz Amason of Washington County, and Republican State Representative Tom Trail of Moscow. Also speaking during the forum was Democratic State Senator Dan Schmidt and other members of the audience. The forum includes references to House Bill 464, which would prohibit city and county governments from regulating certain kinds of drilling and most aspects of fracking. That bill passed in the House 54-13 on Friday and is now heading to the Senate. The bill leaves all decision on sitting oil and gas wells to the Idaho Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which is currently made up of Governor C.L. Butch Otter, Secretary of State Ben Usursa, Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin, Controller Donna Jones, and Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Luna. The bill was co-sponsored by House Speaker Lawrence Denny and Representative Jody Boyle, both Republicans from Midvale. Midvale is in Washington County, where county commissioners have been working to regulate gas drilling and fracking.
The fracking forum was sponsored by Wild Idaho Rising Tide, the Palouse Environmental Sustainability Coalition, and the Palouse Group of the Sierra Club. The moderator is Helen Yost of Wild Idaho Rising Tide.
I guess you all know I work here. We have five folks here. I want to introduce them to you. I'm sure you all know our Representative Tom Trail from the Idaho House of Representatives. Liz Amason comes up from, is it Payette or Washington County?
Payette.
Okay, so you're from probably the Weezer area as well.
Well, I live in Payette, but I used to live in Weezer in Washington County. So, yeah.
Okay. And she has been very vocal against some of the things that are happening down in our area. One of the moms that could visit on not just our natural resources, of course, but people. Amanda Buchanan has been invaluable in knowing a lot about the policy, about this, all these different laws that are going through our legislature right now that are going to determine the future of oil and gas development in our state for quite a while. And she also has been very vocal on it. Kai Huschke is from the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund up in Spokane. His outfit is primarily based out of the Northeast in areas where folks have had a lot of negative impacts from fracking, and he and his company have helped a lot of folks develop just, you know, smaller level government ordinances at city, county level to make sure that there's regulations in place to protect people. And Dr. Jerry Fairley is a hydrogeologist, assistant professor at the University of Idaho. And he knows a lot about fracking, all kinds of underground geologic processes that are impacted by, you know, this industry, and has been for quite some time. So what we're hoping to do is give each panelist about 10 minutes to just talk about their, you know, give some background on the perspective and just talk about sort of how they've been involved. And before each one speaks, I'm going to read short introductions, a little more thorough about what their background is. And then, you know, they'll go through sort of an introductory phase. And then, of course, it's completely open for all, even if you like, for questions. Ask any and everything, because this is a relatively new topic for a lot of people in Idaho. We're sort of late coming to it, and they've been battling with them. So in Idaho for quite some time, so we need to bring ourselves up to speed so we can be responsible citizens and guide our legislature to put some regulations in place. So we're going to start out with Amanda Buchanan. And Amanda is a perennial volunteer activist. She has worked with the Consumers Union, which is the nonprofit publisher of Consumer Reports, since 2008. on healthcare reform, food safety, and patient safety. She's lobbied Congress and even testified for the United States Senate Health Committee in that capacity. Amanda is also a returned Peace Corps volunteer and currently a member of the Board of Trustees of Weezer Memorial Hospital in Weezer, Idaho. Ms. Buchanan became aware of the issue of fracking 2 years ago via a news release on PBS. Last spring, she found out that natural gas drilling was taking place in Payette County and that several landowners in Washington County had leased their mineral rights as well. Thus began Amanda's involvement in this issue. Amanda attended 7 of 10 negotiated rulemaking sessions this past summer at the Capitol, where the Department of Lands, with overwhelming and some would say lopsided help of several gas industry representatives and sparse representation by others, created rules that stand before the legislature today. And those rules were actually have been passed by both the House and Senate at this point. They don't even need to go before, from what I understand, to be, you know, ongoing and set in stone. Ms. Buchanan has a clear understanding of the rules and of the environment in which they were created. She has also been involved in helping Washington County create a county land use oil and gas ordinance to further regulate aspects of oil and gas that's beyond the state rules. And her proposed ordinance will be voted on in mid-February. It's already going through process even just this week. Washington County is the only county in Idaho that has moved to create a local ordinance around oil and gas development.
Hello, everybody. Like Helen said, my name is Amanda Buchanan, and I have spent the last few months really kind of inundating myself with oil and gas rules and what's going on at the state level. I did attend 7 of the 10 negotiated rulemaking sessions, which were an education in itself on the way rules are created for all of us. And if you have any questions about those rules, I can certainly answer them. Like Helen said, there was a vast majority of gas industry presence at the rulemaking. Typically 6 to 7 of those people, 3 industry lawyers, 3 consultants, and a guy who was an expert in the field. On the other side of things, there was a guy from the Idaho Conservation League, myself, and once in a while, a presence from a variety of different smaller organizations. But just because these people were there didn't mean they were actually speaking up. And a lot of people just kind of came and sat and listened. And the majority of the speaking and the majority of the ideas and leadership, so to speak, came from the gas and oil industry. And their basic attitude was, you people know nothing. You haven't had oil and gas in your state, and we know a lot. And therefore, you have no authority to question what we have to say. And we're going to help guide the rules into something that is compatible with other states to try to make it more similar to other states, particularly states that they have a lot of freedom in. And so it was an interesting experience as a citizen and dealing with the state. You know, there was a state presence there. There was the Department of Lands who moderated what was going on. The DEQ had one person there for quite some time, and then 2. And the reason they brought on 2, which they probably wouldn't tell you, is because when they just had 1, they were charged with the responsibility of creating a freshwater protection plan. And when they went back to the DEQ and created what I would consider a very comprehensive freshwater protection plan, they presented it, and the gas industry said, this is unacceptable. Who do you think you are? You have no idea what this industry entails, and you can't authorize us to do anything. And Eric Wilson, who's in charge of the Department of Lands, responded, you're right, this freshwater protection plan seems more like a science experiment, and we're going to go back to the table and make it weaker. I mean, it was really pathetic, and it was a brazen attack on the woman from the DEQ who cried at the meeting. I mean, she was literally attacked by the gas industry. And then following that meeting, every time the DEQ came, they came with a director. And my impression was this man was appalled at how they treated his subordinate, and he came to help defend her for the rest of the meetings. Aside from that experience, there was the Idaho Department of Water Resources. And, you know, a lot of these people just basically sat on their hands the entire time because gas and oil has not been in Idaho, and they didn't feel comfortable speaking up, and they were there to kind of listen and learn. And, you know, after what happened with the DEQ, a lot of them are just kind of like, wow, you know, I think we're just going to sit back and see what happens. And that's what they did. So when you hear the state explain every single entity that was involved, sure, all those people were there at some point or another. But did all of those people speak up? No. You know, they like to tout the fact that there was an EPA person at all these meetings. Okay, well, the reason the EPA guy was there was that at the first meeting he announced to the state that the state didn't have the authority to create rules about Class II injection wells. And he also had come from the gas and oil industry, and he sat the remainder of the meetings talking about casings and wells and how gas and oil was fine because he never saw any problems. He never once talked about, you know, what he thought environmental kinds of rules should be around gas and oil. But yet, at the end of these meetings, you'll hear all these guys from the government say, and there was a guy from the EPA there. It meant nothing, I can tell you. He was asleep half the time. I mean, it meant nothing. And so when you hear this being represented to you like, hey, guess what? All these people were there, and it was very fair, and everybody got a say. I'll agree. If you wanted to say something in the microphone, they allowed you to speak. Did they listen to you? Not necessarily. Often I was the only citizen there. Did they listen to me? No. So if you're worried about the rules, you should be worried about the rules. And if you have any questions about them, I can go over them. And in the meantime, Washington County, where I'm from, Weezer, the Weezer Midvale Cambridge area, decided before the state even underwent their negotiating rulemaking sessions, the fact that drilling was beginning south of us in Payette County with basically rules that were from 1994, our county government kind of freaked out, and rightfully so. They said, wow, these rules are so outdated, this is insane, and we've got to get rules in place before these people come into our county and start drilling gas with no rules. And so they put together a lot of rules. They tried to send it through the commissioners, and it passed through the planning and zoning. The commissioner stopped it. They said they didn't think things were to the liking of the gas industry. We changed some things and went through again. The hearing was Halloween. Same thing. The majority of citizens came out and said, please pass this ordinance. And two of our commissioners said, well, you know, the state's working on its rules. They're going to preempt a lot of what we have. We really need to wait and hold back. And so they did. And they went through our rules line by line against the state's proposed rules, which as a citizen makes you feel pretty uncomfortable that they're willing to retract rules based on proposed rules, but that's what they did. And they went through line by line and took out everything they felt like the state, you know, kind of had a grip on in their proposed rules. And our next hearing is this Monday. We do have two commissioners who have absolutely said the ordinance needs to pass. Well, in the meantime, the gas industry, they came to all of our hearings and said they didn't like our rules and that they were too strong. They said they were the strongest rules they'd ever seen in their lives, which was not true. But they all came from Arkansas, and Arkansas doesn't have a lot of county ordinances. So, you know, I guess they were basing it on their Arkansas experience. And so they put a lot of pressure on our county government. The state government, the governor, the lieutenant governor put a lot of pressure on the county and said, you know, you guys, you're going to make it really hard. You're inhibiting the industry from thriving because you have these rules. And let me tell you, the rules include things like having a setback from residences, not putting a well in a floodplain. I mean, these are really basic things to protect human health and safety and quality of life. And the government didn't want them to do it. And so when we went through our third round of going through our ordinance, our county government finally said, fine, if your big problem is we're not including the gas industry, we'll include them. And our county prosecuting attorney went and met with Snake River Oil and Gas's attorney, and this attorney went through our ordinance line by line and said every little thing that he didn't like that he thought that they were willing to sue us over. And our attorney brought that back to the county, and they went through it line by line and took all of that under consideration. Our commissioners called this attorney and said, you know, we're in the process of taking this under consideration. The attorney said, great, take your time. We're happy to work with you. And then it turned out that in the meantime, that attorney and the Idaho Petroleum Council were writing their own legislation to preempt county authority. So that's the reality, folks. I mean, they have no intention of following rules that they don't want to follow. And so what they did was they created this legislation behind everybody's back. When it finally came to light, our county commissioners were, of course, furious and felt like they had been backstabbed by the industry, which they had been. And what made it worse was the industry then decided, well, the first legislation they proposed was just awful. It basically said only the state had any siting authority. The counties had zero authority, and it went through this like long list of things that the county had no authority over. Basically, the county had authority over the color of paint on the wellhead and the type of fencing they could put. I mean, it was ridiculous. And luckily, they went to the Association of Counties, and the Association of Counties was told, don't work with Washington County. Their ordinance is the poster child for preemption. Leave these people out of it. They're only going to cause trouble. So they went to the Association of Counties, and they changed a few things, but the powers that be told the Association of Counties, and this was in an article in the Statesman a couple days ago, if you do not endorse our bill, we will write another bill, and counties will have no authority. Essentially, counties were coerced into endorsing this bill, which is the bill, House Bill 464, that passed on Thursday. In it, there reads a line, and I just want to read it to you so you get kind of a full understanding of the scope of this. No ordinance, resolution, requirement, or standard of a city, county, or political subdivision, except a state agency with authority, shall actually or operationally prohibit the extraction of oil and gas. So what that essentially means is no city, no county, no political authority can say, we don't really want you to drill in our town. You know, and it's one thing we all imagine, they're drilling outside of towns. Well, that's fine, but guess what this legislation says? They can drill anywhere they want, and you cannot stop them. And this is what we're dealing with. This is just past the House. It's going to the House. Well, it just passed the House committee. It's going to the floor. We'll soon be in the Senate. And that's what we're up against. That's my spiel.
So next up is Liz Amason. And Liz is an Idaho resident who's been educating herself and others over the last 4 years on health and environmental issues. She is an area coordinator of the Idaho Business Women's Network, where she promotes her natural nutritional supplements and non-toxic cleaning products. And just this last month, she was named 2011 Businesswoman of the Year.
Nice.
Besides membership in her local Chamber of Commerce's and Snake River Alliance, Liz is also an active member and vice chair of the Snake River chapter of Oregon Rural Action. Additionally, Liz is an Idaho organizing, or she's on the Idaho organizing committee for a new Idaho chapter of the Western Organization of Resource Councils. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about all those organizations.
Southern Idaho fracking activist Liz Amason of Washington County.
Okay, thank you very much. So I started out, I blog. I have a little green blog, and which I haven't been blogging on for the last few months since I've been dealing with the fracking. There's only so many hours in the day. I work a full-time job, and then I work my little business. And so in my process of learning about environmental stuff and sharing it on my blog, I learned about fracking, and I didn't even know that it was already coming in to the Payette County area. I have to admit, I wasn't a very conscientious citizen paying attention to what was going on in meetings and forums and that. And so it kind of snuck in, and the exploratory wells and everything had been drilled in Payette County, and they'd found natural gas before I realized what was going on. So I belonged already to the Oregon Rural Action, which the Snake River chapter, which sits on the Ontario, Oregon sits right on the Payette and Oregon border, and Payette, Idaho, and Ontario, Oregon, you know, are right there. The Snake River divides them. So the Oregon Rural Action works both sides of the border. So we started working in that organization, trying to get the word out about what was going on. And then I was also connected with an organizer for this organization called WORCS, Western Organization of Resource Councils, they were starting an Idaho chapter, and they just hadn't picked a location of where to start developing their first chapter in Idaho. They're in six other states, I believe: Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, and Montana.
Colorado.
Thank you. Colorado. So between the WORCS involvement and organizing that chapter and being a member of Oregon Rural Action, I started getting more in touch with more people about everything that was going on and networking. And actually, the organizer of the WORCS chapter connected me with Travis and Tina Fisher of Fruitland, and Tina's here tonight. And their big issue was, and I didn't know what was going on, was that Payette County Planning and Zoning was approving a conditional use permit for a dehydration and compression station right in Tina and Travis's backyard in land that is zoned Ag 1. And I don't know if any of you know what a dehydration compression station looks like or sounds like, but if you don't, you can look it up online. It's a little industrial facility, and this is sitting in pristine farmland is where they want to put it, and you know, where there's milk cows down the road and people are farming and growing corn next door and that sort of thing. There's an organic farm down the street and that sort of thing. So we got in the battle with the Fishers and some of their neighbors in that, trying to let the Payette County people know what was going on, and also trying to educate the planning and zoning and the commissioners, which was an uphill battle that basically we lost. And in the end, the Payette Planning and Zoning approved a conditional use permit to go in to put this dehydration station right there in Fruitland. And there's a lot of environmental impacts from a dehydration compression station. There's volatile organic compound issues. There's the noise, which is quite excessive. The aesthetics of it just doesn't fit in with the community. It's not where it belongs. It belongs somewhere out in an industrial area. So we're just continually trying to be out there letting people know what's going on. And it's really interesting. Most people initially, if they know about the natural gas well drilling, they're up front, they're for it, because they think it means jobs and to, you know, improve our economy and that sort of thing. But then when you have a chance to sit down with them one-on-one and show them what is going on in the other states where this has been going on for so many years, and the devastation documented, you know, proof and studies, they easily change their mind about how they feel about it. So that's just, I think that's our biggest, in my mind, the biggest battle is just educating people.
Speaking of which, I'm sorry, what is this dehydration compression station, the purpose of it?
They run the liquid natural gas through there to pull out and to clean it and send it into the Williams pipeline. It can't go into the actual pipeline where the gas is dispersed until it's been cleaned. Yeah.
And you get a lot of volatiles.
Oh yeah, yeah. And that's another thing, you know, they keep saying that natural gas, and you know, the Jerry down there had said in the earlier meeting that, you know, it's natural gas is cleaner, but there's a new study. Well, the study came out in April, Dr. Tony Ingrafia from back east with some other professionals in this field. And then they were countered by an industry study that called BS on some of their stuff. So Dr. Ingrafia and those people redid a study, which I have redid it and proved everything that and substantiated everything that they said in their original study, that all the processes that they have to go to from beginning to end with the natural gas extractions and everything and getting it into the pipeline actually causes more greenhouse gas emissions than coal does. And they have documented proof. I mean, they've done the homework. So, you know, I don't know.
Is there anybody on our side in government at all?
There's some senators, for sure. There's some senators.
Yeah, there are some senators that are, but, you know, it's such a minority. It's so bizarre. We were at this, you know, I was at some of the rulemaking sessions too, not as many as Amanda, and I agree with everything she said, but there was they were there acting on behalf of the Idaho Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, the state, which is Tom Luna, Donna Jones, the governor,
was in the Attorney General.
Yeah, the Attorney General and so forth. None of them were there. None of them knew what was going on, and they're the ones who are ultimately have the say in everything, which I just thought was, you know, very interesting. And they're the ones in this proposed legislation that takes away local control that will be the ones making the decisions and having the last word. So it's very scary.
You're listening to a forum on fracking in Idaho held at the Hamilton Indoor Recreation Center in Moscow, Saturday, February 11th.
So next up is Jerry Farrelly. I guess I didn't tell you that. So, and some of you have heard this introduction already, so bear with me, but Dr. Jerry Farrelly is an associate professor of hydrogeology in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Idaho here in Moscow, where he teaches courses in geomorphology, groundwater study techniques, and hydrogeologic systems modeling. He's a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley, where he earned his PhD in Earth Resources Engineering, or hydrogeology. He also holds an MS in Geosciences from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and a BS in Geology from the State University of New York at Portland. Before August 2000, Jerry investigated flow processes in unsaturated fractured rock for Earth Sciences Division of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, which is one of the premier research groups in the world. He has also worked as a senior staff hydrologist for Woodward Clyde Consultants and for the Desert Research Institute and several smaller consulting firms. But beyond his career, Dr. Farrelly is an accomplished swimmer. He actually swam in 1999 from Alcatraz Island to San Francisco in a race known as Alcatraz.
You escaped.
And so besides enjoying solo mountaineering as a rock climber, he's also placed 13th in the Spider-Man category of the Keyhole Classic in Nevada. And he also likes to sail, mountain bike, spelunk, and snorkel. He also has a cultural taste in things like opera and symphonic music, outdoor Shakespearean theater, and then of course, like all of us, he likes good food and wine and restaurants.
University of Idaho hydrogeologist Jerry Farrelly.
Thank you again for that lovely introduction. Well, I think most people here probably heard what I had to say earlier, and I think that the main things that I guess I would like to repeat for the benefit of those who are not there to hear what I had to say is that I am actually a proponent of fracking if it's carefully done and well regulated. I think that it can be done carefully and it can be well regulated. I think that there have been a lot of problems associated with fracking in the last 15 or 20 years, and I think that that's because of a couple of things. Number one, I think because it's a very poor regulation, very poor oversight, and I also think it's because large areas of land are being fracked that would never have been exploited for gas resources or oil before, and these are primarily in the shale basin. So this is in the northeast of the United States, the Marcellus Shales and Moscow Shales, in Arkansas and the Fayetteville Shales, in Wyoming and some of these places. And I think that there's no questioning some of the environmental destruction and havoc that's been wreaked on these areas because of the lack of oversight and because of the use of these technologies in very shallow places and places where the purported reservoir rocks are going to be in close contact with water wells, with drinking water, with groundwater that can be used for beneficial purposes. I think that, as I said earlier, fracking has been going on commercially at least since 1947, and there's very little, in fact, there's no evidence of any harm coming from that before we started doing these type of shallow fracks and large scale, multiple fractures from horizontal wells. And what I didn't say earlier, but perhaps probably maybe nobody here knows, is that about 10% of our economy in the United States comes from breaking rock. It's kind of a startling thing, right? That includes things like sand and gravel quarrying, mining, and stuff like that. We all know that Idaho is a big natural resource state. That's one of the things we have here for our economy. It's a big agriculture state. Fracking is a huge part of that 10%. And so gas and oil are a big part of our economy. Fracking is a big part of our economy. I don't think that we can do away with it. I also mentioned earlier, and I still stand by this, that a lot of green energy relies on fracking. So lots of us would like to see geothermal. I personally am a big proponent of geothermal energy in Idaho. I think it's a clean, safe energy, something that we can develop here. It's homegrown. Perhaps most of you don't know, but it's very difficult for us to get more power in the state of Idaho. Okay, all our transmission lines are at capacity right now. Construction of new transmission lines cost about $1 million a mile. Okay, so we're not going to probably be building a lot of new transmission lines in the near future, certainly not to this part of the country or of the state. One really nice thing about geothermal power is that it can be done locally, it can be built near the site of consumption, and so that provides local jobs, it provides a green, low greenhouse gas emissions, pretty clean, small footprint environmentally, source of energy. Okay. But geothermal can't work without fracking. Usually, pretty much all the geothermal, certainly anything that we do in the state of Idaho, especially on the Snake River Plain in those areas, is going to be deep. It's going to be below any beneficial groundwater that we're going to be using for beneficial use. The danger of this, and I was actually talking to some people before I came here, or before we came here from the previous area, it is true that there are always risks associated with these types of things because of the potential for leaking of the wells and insufficient grouting jobs around well casings and stuff. This is something that requires a lot of oversight and it requires care. These things happen, right? But I do believe it's something that we can work with, and I think if we want to maintain our economy, we need to think about those things. I am not, by any stretch of the imagination, anti-environmental. I hope I wouldn't want anybody to take that home with them and think that I was anti-environmental. I think that it's very important that we safeguard our environment, and I also think that it's very important that we think carefully about what we're going to do and that we take into account our environment and protecting our environment, protecting our people, and there are multiple ways to do that. But I don't think that we can afford to just get rid of fracking. I think that we need careful oversight at all levels, local level, regional, state.
Just a quick question, though. To frack geothermal, you wouldn't use the over 700 chemicals that they're using to frack for natural gas, or would you?
I personally wouldn't. Right. Usually, for geothermal wells, what you use is you use water. You use some kind of a, what we were talking about earlier, a proppant, some kind of a sand or ceramic beads or something like that. And sometimes that you use some like polymers, because what happens is when the water gets down into those very high temperatures, you know, it just wants to flash to steam. It can't carry proppants into the fractures anymore and whatnot. I personally, and I actually mentioned this earlier, for those of you that weren't there, I'll say this again. I personally believe in full disclosure of all the chemicals or anything that go down a well. And so when I talk about, I think the fracking is an important part of our economy, and I think it's an important part of our ability to maintain our society. I think that also part of our responsibility is to make sure that we people have full information about these things and that they can make intelligent decisions about these things.
You're listening to a forum on fracking in Idaho held at the Hamilton Indoor Recreation Center in Moscow, Saturday, February 11th.
How much water is involved in the fracking process? I know more about what's happening in the east of Pennsylvania, and I know there was a plan to take a pipeline in Erie, hundreds of miles inland, to develop huge quantities of water. It's not my
absolutely.
But I don't have that much water.
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely true. In the Northeast, it's true in these shale basins. When we talk about Arkansas, we talk about Wyoming, we talk about the Marcellus Shales in New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, these are very large frack jobs. They require enormous quantities of water. There's no question about that. And in some of those areas of the country, you have that water. Not so much in Wyoming, but certainly in the Northwest or the Northeast you do. And Arkansas is right on the Mississippi River. The gas plays are right near the Mississippi River. So perhaps you have that water. I wouldn't be an expert on that. I wouldn't say that. What we're looking at in Idaho, from my understanding of the situation, and I talked about this earlier, I'm not an expert on this, but I did look into it, and from what has been published, the fracks that they're talking about are relatively small, and they expect them to use on the order of 30,000 gallons of water. I'm not saying I'm not an expert on those, and there are other people that might be more informed about those particular fracking jobs, but what has been published, what has been let out to the public, is that the fracking jobs here are relatively small and won't use kind of water. I think when you talk about these giant fracking jobs, you're talking about these big shale plays, and the only way to make those profitable is with these enormous fracking jobs, and essentially what we're doing is rubblizing the subsurface. I'm not particularly a proponent of that. That's not the situation in Idaho. Idaho is looking at lake sediments, and so they don't require those same kind of enormous fractions. I'm sorry?
Why did they change from the deep to shallow?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. Earlier I was mentioning this, that I grew up in upstate New York. That's where I went to high school, and they were doing seismic monitoring there looking for gas, and everybody knew that there was gas in the organic shales there, in the organic rich shales. But nobody knew how to get it out. And so there's been a lot of technological changes, and some of these chemicals are one of the things that have come along to make it more practical to frack large quantities of these shales. Again, I'm not a proponent of this. There is one thing that I should mention. You hear a lot these days about how this, I think it came up in this film, about there's a sea of natural gas out there, or whatever it was. My understanding from talking to some of the people in the USGS is that there's a strong feeling in the USGS that they may be downgrading the resources that are available out there by as much as an order of magnitude. Which is not actually particularly surprising to me, because usually when something new is discovered or people start to evaluate it, they whip up a lot of frenzy, they want to get investors going and whatnot, and so they say, oh, we've got these giant resources. Now, I don't pretend to know what the USGS or anybody else is going to do, but my understanding is that perhaps those reservoirs have been overestimated in how much there really is there. So,
is that what Pickett was talking about? Like, he got on the TV and started saying natural gas, that's what America needs to look for.
Right, yeah.
Do you want to get through the rest of the...
Yeah, maybe we should, yeah.
Can I ask one more question? Actually, it's a very quick one, I think. On the eastern part of the state, out near the Montana and Wyoming border, We heard in committee from the geologists for Snake River Gas and Oil that that's the next play. So because of the proximity to Montana and Wyoming and knowing the geology there, is it not possible that we're looking at large fractures happening over in the eastern part of the state in those plays on that side of the state?
I couldn't make actual specific comments about that because I am unfamiliar with the exact geology of that area. What I do know is that it's possible that there, I mean, certainly it's close to Wyoming, it's close to Montana. Also, though, that corner of Idaho has got a lot of residual heat from volcanism, because that's where the hotspot moved through, and that has a tendency to destroy petroleum resources. So you get a certain amount of petroleum of heat, you get gas and oil, or you get oil. A little bit more heat, you get mixed gas and oil. A little bit more heat, you get what's called dry gas, which is what's in Idaho. And then it all goes away. So I don't really know. I can make specific comments about that area or say what I think might be the next thing. I haven't studied that. I don't know.
But they're drilling outside of Yellowstone, so we know there's some wells over.
I don't know about that. Sorry about that.
Thank you.
Sure. Next up is Kai.
Sorry.
And Kai is the Washington State organizer. advisor for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which is the nation's leading expert on drafting local laws that would prohibit natural gas drilling as a violation of the community's rights. And I believe your organization was also involved in some of the democracy schools you might have heard about up in Spokane. And of course, there was a community bill of rights that was put on the ballot a couple times in that city as well recently. CELDF recently taught a workshop in Ontario, Oregon, attended by concerned citizens and elected officials from across southern Idaho, but most specifically Payette and Washington counties, which are targeted for fracking operations by the oil and gas industry.
Kai Hushke of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund.
So I'm going to get into kind of the legal governmental sort of side of it. So folks kind of get some better understanding, especially in a state of which the practice of fracking hasn't even begun yet. So our work's been primarily in the places where it's been taking place, so Pennsylvania, Maryland, Ohio, New York, West Virginia, working with folks in Colorado and New Mexico. And to kind of preface, I guess, the rest of what I'll say is there's a strong divergence with these communities in the realm of regulating versus prohibiting. So these communities are done playing the regulation game. They've seen how the regulatory process works, or in essence on their community level doesn't work, and they moved into a whole different realm now. And I'll kind of give into some explanation of why they've gotten to that place and why it's really bigger than just fracking. It really has to do with just about any major issue that we come across as a community. Who drives the process? Why is it that certain decision makers get to make the decisions they do, and why we on the local levels are basically disempowered to have any actual real power in what happens? So I thought I'd start with a couple of quotes from news releases that have come out in the last year and a half. These are communities that we've worked with, who've actually passed local laws, in essence elevating community rights, the rights to clean air, clean water, the rights to the ecosystems, and actually putting those above corporate rights, and in the process prohibiting the practice of natural gas drilling. So it gets into a very different realm than what is currently taking place in the state of Idaho, though there are some folks that are starting to get to that point where they understand that it's not a practice that can be regulated, and that it has to be not only prohibited on the local level, but on the grander scale of things. If we're really serious about getting off of fossil fuels, why are we not being serious about getting off of fossil fuels? So here's some of the quotes. This is from the mayor of a place called Forest Hills, Pennsylvania. The mayor here said, "My support of a ban was based on the fact that there is scientific evidence that this hydraulic fracking causes problems with the environment and problems with health." From an organizer in a community in New York, "What we're interested in doing is passing a civil rights-based ordinance, which is a law that will protect us from the oil and gas industry in our neighborhood." So there's some of the sentiments from folks in places back east where they've seen it firsthand. From another organizer in Pennsylvania, "If we don't take a stand in a foundational way against these huge corporations, we're going to get run over." From Pittsburgh City Councilman Doug Shields, "The city of Pittsburgh was the first community in the United States to pass a ban on fracking. It was passed by a unanimous vote of their city council back in November of 2010. And this is what Councilman Doug Shields had to say about it. Said, "This ordinance recognizes and secures expanded civil rights for the people of Pittsburgh, and it prohibits activities which would violate those rights. It protects the authority of the people of Pittsburgh to pass this ordinance by undoing corporate privileges that place the rights of people of Pittsburgh at the mercy of gas corporations." And then the last quote here is from Mayor Leo Martin. He's the mayor of Mountain Lake Park, Maryland. He says here, "Our town government is responsible for the health, safety, and rights of our citizens. When the county, state, and federal governments fail in their duties, it is our duty to take action." So to kind of give you the sentiment of where elected officials and citizens have gotten to in regards to this issue, primarily now back east, but as I said, we're working with places now back out here in the west. And it comes from a lot of different places, more so than we probably can get into tonight. But the big thing that folks are seeing play out here that Amanda referenced, and I'm sure other questions will come up, is really this idea of state power, or what we would call state preemption. So in essence, we have a governmental system of which the federal trumps the state and the state trumps the local. And it's the basic explanation of how our government operates. And we see it very much play out when it comes to corporate industrial practices of high importance. And of course, in the energy specter of things, oil and gas is of a severe interest to a lot of folks. And of course, a lot of moneyed folks, which tend to be, you know, in the form of large corporations. And so what we see happening here in the state of Idaho, and what we've seen in, with our organization back east, is they point all their activities at the state level. So they look at state legislation. So they look at the regulations. So every industry has some sort of regulations. And so their whole job is to obviously to put regulations in place that allow the activity to proceed. And another way to put it is they put systems in place of which then corporations primarily have to go and actually apply for a permit. So you go through the whole permitting process. And we as a law firm, we spent 8 years in the regulatory world basically appealing permits of corporations. And what we understood is that all that regulations really did was not really regulate industries, it regulated us as activists or us as community members. So we've done doing that. In the regulatory world, as you see now playing out, regulations are put in place. Quite often it's industry who are writing these regulations. You guys here in Idaho get to see it real time. it's not very secretive. You see it basically unfolding before you about who's writing the regulations. So in essence, you have regulations that get set, you file for your permit, and you actually get to do your activity. So in essence, what you're doing is you're permitting a certain practice. In this case, what you're doing is you're legalizing a certain amount of environmental damage. So you're legalizing pollution is ultimately what it comes down to. And then you get to regulate about how much pollution is good pollution. And of course, these communities back east have seen what that means to them as their water gets despoiled, as their environment gets destroyed, as their communities get degraded from all different perspectives. And another aspect of the regulatory world is you can take a complex problem and it basically gets winnowed down to something very simplistic. You look at usually a single issue when it comes to regulations. So what was seen as a complex problem from a community level now becomes about parts per million or whatever it is that gets looked at, how many gallons or how often trucks can drive. So it gets mitigated down to very sort of superficial things, of which the community still sees the seriousness of it. But of course they can't argue that because that's not the law, because that's not regulatory law. And in the oil and gas world, you have oil and gas commissions. So you have this on every state level, pretty much. There's an oil and gas commission. You can look at their charge online. And their primary charge is for the efficient extraction of a resource. If you're looking for the environmental stuff, it's there, but it's usually there very far down. And of course, as we've seen on the federal level, there's already been exemptions on the environmental front. Even on the state level, the various proposals that have come through have been reducing the environmental protections. And I find it very interesting, if it's so safe, then why is this big push about extracting local control over it if it's such a safe practice? I find that very interesting. So the regulatory world is usually what communities run up against first. So when we work with communities, they're usually running up against the state first because the state has some sort of permitting process. So everyone drives everyone to the state to see what is the permitting process. And so it's never about saying no to something. It's about some form of regulation or mitigating it. And these communities have seen the impact of what fracking has looked like, and so they're done doing the regulatory stuff. But that's usually the first thing you run up against. The other things that we run up against in our activism on the community level, whoever it may be, are a lot of other things as well. There's a lot of other legal doctrines out there that basically shape our activism, that keep us in a certain box. And corporate constitutional rights, which have gotten a lot of play around Citizens United and corporate campaigns, it's far more expansive than that. Corporations use their constitutional rights protections all the time. And so this is why a lot of this industrial stuff gets pushed through, is because if you don't allow it to happen, you end up violating the corporation's constitutional rights. So in essence, the corporation's rights, trump our community rights. So it should be no surprise that this activity happens. And it should be no surprise at which how the corporations go about putting the systems in place that allow these activities to take place. So you run up against state preemption. You run up against corporate constitutional rights. It's very interesting in the Idaho situation, I'll be really quick and wrap up here, is you run into things like legal doctrines that exist, like Dillon's Rule. Basically, Dillon's Rule says that the state is the parent and the municipality is the child. So in essence, whatever the state says, whatever the parent says, is what the child can do. And those powers can be taken away and those powers can be given. In essence, municipal governments, county governments are basically at the mercy of the state government. So again, no one should be surprised on the functional level how government works when local power gets extracted, because in reality, the state can do that. And of course, you're seeing it play out here in the state of Idaho, because it's being at the behest of corporate interests, they're actually looking at pulling local control away. So I guess just to wrap it up, the problem is bigger than fracking, it's bigger than coal extraction, it's bigger than factory farms, it's bigger than all the corporate threats that you may or may not have an interest in. And what it really boils down to is that we have, in essence, no local self-government. We truly have no power to say no or even to say yes to certain activities. So the way that we've looked at it now, having done this work for 15 years, is it's not really a fracking problem, it's a democracy problem. And so what we've seen with these communities is actually push really for democracy over everything else. And in the process, they've prohibited these threats that have come in. And what they're doing is they're stepping out of the box. And in a lot of cases, they're getting hit, and they're getting hit hard, because people say you can't step out of the box. The laws say you can't step out of the box. The culture says you can't step out of the box. But what we've seen now is communities, 130 now in different realms, have stepped outside of the box, and in essence are blazing kind of a new path around what does a democracy look like? What does government look like? And on a larger scale, what does sustainability look like, whether it's energy or economy or otherwise? And so, in essence, what you're running into, Idaho is no exception, is this is how the system functions. And in essence, you have no power to say no until you actually begin to look differently how you organize yourself and actually what you stand for. And this is really the work that we do in supporting these communities has come about, so.
I'll stop there.
So last up is our representative. Dr. Trail is a Republican member of Idaho House of Representatives. He's been serving District 6A for 8 terms since 1996, with a term expiration upcoming at the end of 2012. Tom graduated from Moscow High School and earned a bachelor's degree in animal science from the University of Idaho. And a master's degree from the University of Maryland College of Heart. He earned his doctorate. I couldn't figure out if it was in psychology or education. Psychology. From Montana State University. Trail has served in the U.S. Army Reserve, the Peace Corps, as an educational consultant, and he was a professor for 25 years at Washington State University. Tom is a member of the Moscow Rotary Club, Chamber of Commerce, and League of Women Voters, and a recipient of several awards and fellowships throughout his career. During the last two-year legislative sessions, Tom has chaired the Agricultural Affairs Committee and has been a member of the Commerce and Human Resources, as well as the Education Committees. Most recent among his key votes, he opposed House Bill 404, and that was here just in the last few weeks, which prohibits camping on Capitol Mall property. And he also opposed the controversial S-1184 back in 2011. That was the Education Bill Technology in the Classroom, which appropriates funds for performance pay for teachers and for public school technology and authorizes parents of high school students to enroll their children in online courses. Not only has Tom been concerned with higher education throughout his terms in the House, he has also closely followed the natural gas drilling developments in southern Idaho through his cousin, John Trail, who is a farmer down in that area.
State Representative Tom Trail of Moscow.
Thank you very much, Helen. All of us have heard the Dr. King's famous statement, "I had a dream." Well, this is my dream. I'm in charge of organizing all of the rulemaking process with the oil and natural gas people and all the politicians who are making decisions. They sit down and we watched the movie Aaron Brockovich with Julia Roberts for 2 hours. Very considerately, we have nice bottled water all the way around the table. And at the end of the movie, we say, and by the way, this water came from a well near one of the new gas wells. I would love to have a video of the expression though. We talk about education, and I think maybe that's a shock treatment, but I think that brings out a lot, it would get some real reaction. Maybe some of these folks would start to think a little bit more about what's going on. Back December 1st, I heard Lieutenant Governor Brad Little give a speech to a group of legislators, and he came out very strongly saying that protection of our water resources is a top priority in the state of Idaho. And he also said, backing that up, our last speaker mentioned constitutional protection. In the Idaho Constitution, we have a general welfare clause, and I think there is precedent from our general welfare clause, whether we go to the U.S. Constitution or our own Idaho Constitution, that we do indeed have legally protection to protect public health. I think most of us in this room know that we have a big disconnect in the state of Idaho between the reality of what our citizens believe in and would support and what the majority of our legislators and the governor support. And this is pretty well, I think, the Megalode situation is one. And the three pillars of Tom Luna's educational, we can go on this. And we do have a few victories along the way. But I would ask all of you, as the election comes up this coming fall, to very closely scrutinize the contribution, the donor list, even though the super PACs can cover that up a bit. But we, on the Upper Knoxville Exchange, did a little research there, and congressional delegation, governor, and some other key people had substantial contributions from folks who were on the other side. Just say, follow the gold, and I think that brings us up. An interesting blog I ran across, it was in some contaminated wells allegedly caused by poor fracking procedures back in Pennsylvania. It created a lot of jobs in the public health service.
So yeah, that's positive thing.
We have positive thing. You know, it's interesting to note that in January this year, there were a group of doctors back in Pennsylvania who called for a moratorium on fracking in populated areas until more research is needed. There were signs there of methane leakage and other contaminants as well. You know, and I was just absolutely overwhelmed by some of the figures of it may take up to 10 million gallons, depending on the type of strata and so forth, over the life of the well, and maybe up to 100,000 gallons of additives, and you know, 650, 700 different types, many of which are carcinogenic. And another little bullet that really hit me is that back in 2005, chemical drilling is exempt from our federal laws in terms of our Clean Water Act, and that's called the Halliburton Loop, of which a former vice president was predominantly in charge of. Well, we've all heard, I think, a lot of the problems and so forth, and I'll agree with our speaker at the University of Idaho, and I just sort of like to conclude with an eight-step plan that I've outlined. First of all, I think that if we do the job well and it's regulated with careful oversight, that fracking could be indeed carried out successfully. But here are the points that I would like to see implemented. First of all, and this is one nobody's talked about, full financial disclosure from the gas or oil company. Because we have a lot of financially distressed gas and oil companies that just do not have the deep pockets to respond to emergencies, and they're slipshod in their techniques. And we need to have a record of where they have drilled, what their record has been for quality control. Also, another point would be to require disclosure of the chemicals that are used in the chemical package that they're using in fracking. A couple of states like Pennsylvania and New York do. Now you can you can argue all you want to about protection of trade secrets, but it's either public health or protection of trade secrets. Those are the trade-offs. And if you don't publicly disclose and have the ingredients that you have on record with your local state DEQ on record for the public, then no business. Also, monitoring of these operations should be carried out by an independent organization. Those of you, I think, that have studied the Athabascan sand tars situation, for example, for years the monitoring was carried out by the oil companies, and always with reports that there were no carcinogenic agents, even though the rates of cancer were sky high in some of the native villages. And finally, after a long fight, the Canadian government finally caved in, and an independent organization funded by the oil and gas companies, I think that's absolutely essential in terms of, again, public health. Required bonding of the companies, I think that's another step that should be carried out. We also need to put pressure on our president and also Congress to close the loopholes in eliminating the fracking exemptions and granting EPA added power and authority under the Clean Water Act. So we hit it both in the state and the national level. We also needed added protection to allow local citizens to enact zoning laws and ordinances to protect public health, and also to require the companies to have water protection plans and emergency backup plans in case there is an emergency. Last of all, one that has I frequently hear but not discussed much in the press, protection of property values, for example.
That's
an extremely important point to me. Now, how you go about that, I think there are various ways we could use. And so those are sort of 8 points that I've summarized in terms of my study and discussions with others. And with that, I'm going to turn it back to our moderator.
You're listening to a forum on fracking in Idaho held at the Hamilton Indoor Recreation Center in Moscow, Saturday, February 11th.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and Ponderosa Rentals, providing quality home rentals in Moscow since 2006.
KRFP is also supported by Tie-Dye Everything, specializing in locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located behind Mikey's at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. You can also find Tie-Dye Everything at tiedye-everything.com.
You are listening to KRFP. Moscow 92.5 FM.
So I guess it's open to questions now. We'll do folks that came up from southern Idaho, and I guess for all of us people that don't know as much about it, I'm going to answer the questions, but we're asking folks, don't ask too many questions in a row, so we all can have our concerns addressed. And it's completely open. If things lag, I wrote down some points. And make sure you get everything you can. These are all very knowledgeable people that have come to help us learn about this issue. So I guess if you want to just stand and make sure that the microphones can hear your question, I guess it's a concern. Or you don't have to stand and just say who you're addressing your question to. I guess I'm just going to start picking hands. And, I guess Rob, you want
to okay. I heard it suggest that maybe a good idea would be to put some sort of tracers in the fracking water. Have any of you heard or have that done? Heard of that being done, or does it work?
Who do you
want to
answer the question?
I'll take a crack at it.
No pun intended.
Yeah. No pun intended, yes.
University of Idaho hydrogeologist Jerry Fairley.
Certainly this is something that can be done. And I had not thought of that, and I had not heard that before earlier this evening, but I think it's a great idea. In some of the larger programs of drilling that I've been involved with that have not involved fracking, but have involved drilling in sensitive areas, we have used tracers in the water or in the air when we were doing air rotary drilling, so that at a later date, if anything came up, that those tracers could be looked at and that could be linked up with the drilling that we did. So that is absolutely something that's possible. I have never heard of that being done with any of the fracking or any commercial oil and gas development. So, but I think it's a great idea.
I just wondered, and I don't know who knows the answer to this. I don't quite understand the mineral rights of natural gas. Are these wells being dug on state land, on federal land, or are people selling private land to them? I don't understand that very basic part of it.
Southern Idaho fracking activist Amanda Buchanan.
Wells can be drilled anywhere. They can be drilled on state land. And the state has a set of very vague rules around what the surface owner's rights would be around that. They can be drilled on land that's owned privately by somebody who's not the owner of the surface. And the rules around that are pretty bad, actually, because they basically say that the surface owner can be compensated for ag income loss and loss of improvements. Whereas in other states, they incorporate loss of any kind of income and also loss in property value. That's not in Idaho's law. Not to mention that person's given 60 days warning before the gas company comes and has the ability to do surface disturbing activity, despite whether or not there's actually a surface agreement in place. And if that happens, then the state determines what the bond should be, which will typically be $5,000.
How do you know who owns your?
You go through a chain of title through your title company. It's, you don't know it just when you sell your house in Idaho. You have to kind of go through a process. If you own your own mineral rights, obviously you are going to be the one to lease them to the company. They're going to come to you and ask you for them, and your terms are going to be a lot better. You also have to kind of be aware that there is this forced pooling that's out there, which means if you own your mineral rights but you don't want to sign a lease, however, everybody around you signs a lease, and the pool that the gas is in is also incorporated in your mineral rights where your land is, the gas company has the right to go to the state, and the state has the right to force you to sign a lease. That way, you get paid for the step, quote unquote, for the step you're taking now. It's uncertain, and you sign the lease, and now suddenly that means you also get a well, and you have no choice. You also don't really have the opportunity to negotiate your lease terms and say the royalty rates. I was told by Eric Wilson from the Department of Lands that your best bet was when they came to you that you just decide to negotiate with them. This is the same guy that calls Gasland a mockumentary, and he's the guy working for the Department of Lands. So there you go.
Southern Idaho fracking activist Liz Omison of Washington County.
Yeah, you see, most people don't own their mineral rights. The state owns 90% of the...
No, that's not true.
No?
Mm-mm. 25%.
Yeah, most people...
850,000 acres total, 25%.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Of the state subsurface mineral rights?
Okay.
Yeah.
Legally, are we almost too late? We're having all these discussions, but I mean, from what you said...
Kai Hushke of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund.
I mean, I'll give you an example in Pennsylvania. I mean, we've seen it in other industries, but we're now seeing it in fracking. There's legislation sitting in their state legislature to not only make it explicit around state preemption, but actually empower the state attorney general to sue municipalities who pass laws that prohibit natural gas drilling. So in essence, to empower your highest state lawyer, who you pay their salary, to come down and sue you for saying no to fracking. So it, in essence, it gets even worse typically when you begin to, stick a pin in things. So, Washington County does what it does to put in a more stringent regulatory scheme. So it's not even about saying no to it. And now you see the reaction to the industry coming to the state legislator to then force in legislation that now actually strips away any local control. And so that's why I say it's much bigger than just the fracking issue. I mean, we've seen it in factory farms, for instance, in Pennsylvania. About 80 different communities have put in some ban on corporate farming within their communities because of large hog factory farms coming in, and also about industry coming in to apply sewage sludge to their farmland. And they said, well, we don't want it because of all the reasons, well, you wouldn't want it. And so eventually what happened is the industry went to the state level, passed a law that empowered the state attorney general to sue municipalities who put laws in place saying we don't want corporate farming in our communities. And so when I say it's a structural stuff or bigger stuff than that, this is another example within the fracking world of how that system works and how, in essence, we don't have the power to say no to it. If anything, we're left with this option of trying to regulate it. And you see in the case of Washington County, who wanted to have more stringent regulations, and now the state coming in and say, well, you can't even have more stringent regulations to it. So it wasn't even saying no about it, as about trying to mitigate some of the impacts of it.
Amanda Buchanan.
Well, and added to that, the state, the Oil and Gas Commission, they're given in statute specific duties. And the first duties, to develop oil and gas and protect people's mineral rights. The second duty is to prevent waste of the mineral. And the third duty is to protect groundwater. That's all they're obligated to do. And not only that, but if for whatever, and Eric Wilson commented, he's the Department of Lands guy that helped write the rules. He commented at the Senate resource meeting, there was a lot of this talk being batted around, like, why are we even going to allow carcinogens to be involved in fracking fluid, and why can't we just say that they can't be in there? And Eric Wilson stood up and he went to the microphone and he said, I just want to be clear, this isn't my personal attitude, but the way the statutes are written, the Department of Lands is absolutely unable to ban carcinogens in fracking fluid because a gas company could say that's the only way we can get them out. And according to the statutes, if that's what they say and their first priority is to develop minerals, then that supersedes protecting groundwater. And he told the senators, I have no choice. I cannot ban this from happening. And he said, if you want to ban it, you need to go a totally different route and put it in statute. Well, and at that point, Senator Work, who I think represents Garden City area, he said, well, it sounds like we need a statute change. So there's a little hope there, I guess, maybe.
Question, has there been any talk at the state level of making sure that Idaho enacts a gas tax on any gas extracted?
Not much.
I think that's a big mistake. Pennsylvania, I guess, just recently put 1%
Right. There is discussion
Tom Trail.
In other states. Pennsylvania is one example of a 1% tax on shale or on extraction.
I think there's only like 7 out of 26 gas drilling states that don't have a tax.
We have a 2.5% tax. We have a 2% severance tax.
We do? Mm-hmm. In Idaho right now?
Yeah, and 14% of that will go to the county. So for every $1 million the gas company makes, the county will get $2,800.
Are you talking about a tax or an impact fee?
Yes.
Yeah, he's talking about an impact fee.
So, no. Yes.
Yeah, no.
So I'm sure that the people of Idaho get compensated for whatever cab is going to be to regulate.
State Senator Dan Schmidt of Moscow.
I'd like to say something. My name's Dan Schmidt. I was on the Energy, Environment, and Technology Interim Committee this last summer that reviewed gas fracking. I'm the state senator from this district, and I was on that committee. We discussed fracking. We were charged this last summer with rewriting the energy plan for the state of Idaho. In that, we took testimony from Payette County and from the oil and gas industry, as well as the Department of Lands. And the recommendation from the interim committee to the legislature was that local control be maintained in the development and processing of natural gas fields. So that was the recommendation from the interim committee, which is it was a committee of mostly moderate Republicans and Democrats, and so, but The bill that's coming through now is not based on that recommendation. It's a different path. And you have to understand that different people introduce different legislation. Just as you mentioned, there are two bills being drafted now that are going to try to include consideration of the public health along with development of natural resources as a priority for the Department of Lands, as well as a bill to prohibit the introduction of carcinogens in fracking material.
Is that bill going to include tracers as well, Senator Smith? Is that the one Senator Smith is working on? Is that what you're talking about?
I am referring to Senator Work's proposed legislation.
Okay.
So I do not know the bill
that
Senator Stennett is working on. So that's the other thing that actually was mentioned this summer when we reviewed this is the difference in geology. There's a lot of concern about fracking. It's very frightening. We've seen a lot of evidence for how it can cause damage. But fundamentally, the geology in Idaho is significantly different from the shale fields elsewhere. The way eastern northern fields that are being considered for exploration may be shale fields. The truth is, they don't know if there's gas there or not. But the field that has been developed in southwestern Idaho, Pays County, consideration in Washington County, is a different geology. So the kind of fracturing that is proposed is not high volume, high pressure fracturing, but a different. And what I have understood about the concerns, this is my concern about Idaho and the development of geological gas extraction. Eric Wilson, you mentioned, Department of Lands, one guy.
Yeah.
Department of Energy in the state of Idaho currently is unfunded. So our ability to provide oversight, our ability to pay attention to what's happening, the negotiated rulemaking process, a few people can take the time mm-hmm. with industry that can show up with a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe that the people we hire, the people that we pay, really are good people, and they do want to protect the state's interests. That's my belief. It may not be yours, but we don't always give them the resources they need to do their job well, and that may take a change in attitude.
So,
Senator
Schmidt, question for John. There is a gentleman in the back that had a question.
I apologize. I'm not.
No, thank you very much. Yeah, please.
Go ahead.
I guess, you know, I hear the idea of well-regulated, well-monitored. I hear what Amanda and Ty are saying about what actually happens. I've lived in a number of states that have had similar kind of research questions. Big funding from big industry always depends. And I guess my question is, so how do, you know, when people like us who have concerns but can't take day after day off work for voting periods, don't have millions of dollars and big lawyers, actually have a huge impact? It seems like every time one of these questions comes up, we get screwed.
Yeah. I mean, that's why these communities are writing their own law. Well, that's the reality of the situation. It doesn't matter what you fight.
Kai Hushke.
You can pick up the fight of whatever you want to fight. The structure is always such that you're disempowered to do anything about it. So that's why I'm saying it's fundamentally about taking out the structure. It's really looking at governmental structures, it's looking at constitutional structures. It looks at what is our priority. And right now, if you look at the constitutional structure and then down to the regulatory structure, the priority is commerce and property. And it's about accelerating those, about everything else. And what you see who's driving it is now the large corporate interests who not only set the laws in order to do it, but also have the wealth to animate it. So in essence, we have a fundamental structural problem about what we see as being perhaps right and just to what is the reality of what the law dictates. And so this is what communities run up against. So whether it's fracking or longwall coal mining or sewage sludge or factory farms or whatever it is that they don't want to see happen because it's not what they want in their community, they run up against that same structure. And so what these communities have started to do is they've started to step out of that structure. Sure. And it's actually worse than that because they actually can supersede the state. Even though states charter corporations, the relationship between a state and a corporation is not a chartered relationship, meaning the state is not more powerful than the corporation. They're actually equals because it's a contractual relationship. And then if you look at the state, if you look at corporate powers as it relates to federal government, they actually trump the state in a lot of regards. So I guess what I'm getting at is it doesn't matter what issue you run up against, unfortunately. I mean, the fracking stuff is serious stuff, and that's a lot of the communities who we work with now back east. But the problem is much larger than that. The solution is people are saying no to that. In essence, they're rebelling against it. They're being civil and disobedient to it by passing law that actually challenges the current structure of law, knowing that we have to get to a different place, knowing that they're up against a very monumental kind of a thing. And so there's no rosy picture at the moment, except that there's enough gumption in these communities to actually do what they're doing. And so we've got 140 communities now that have passed this kind of law that challenge the fundamental structure. And so, I mean, in our work, that's what we've seen. And we played the regulatory game. We played the conventional stuff. We played the in-the-box stuff. It doesn't get you anywhere. And so it's the communities that got us thinking differently, and that's the work we do now, is supporting those communities that are willing to take that on. Because underlying all that is this, like, you know, this question, everyone talks about sustainability, sustainability, sustainability. So what? The question is, do you actually have a structure now that actually allows sustainability to exist? Meaning, can you truly have sustainability on an economic, you know, civil rights aspect, environmental aspect, if you're putting commerce and property above everything else? And these communities in some ways have gotten the conclusion that no, you can't. And so they've ventured off in a new direction. But it's the very beginning of the beginning of actually trying to think differently about how we actually live as people and how we actually live within our natural systems. And why do we let commerce trump everything else? It's one thing when commerce was in 1778, you know, when, you know, we had whatever techniques we had and this and that, and the whole mindset was about great nation building. Yet we still have that same document in place that we live off of, you know, in the 21st century. So I think people are starting to question that, meaning, is this really, do we really have the fundamental right structure, or do we need something else? And then what usually gets them there is these threats, you know, the fracking threat or the factory farm threat. It gets to people to begin to see how the system works, and they go beyond the fact that it's just about corporations. And the factory farm stuff, as I explained earlier, it shows it's the state structure even. It's the state coming down on you saying, no, you can't do this. And so it's much deeper and larger than that, than just the fracking stuff.
Could you give us the names of a couple of communities?
Yeah, I mean, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you know, Rush Township, Pennsylvania. I mean, mainly small communities that have done this. I mean, Spokane's been working for the last 7 years to alter its form of government locally. But I'd be happy to talk to you afterwards on specific examples. So.
I'd like to make a comment here. I'd like to thank everybody in this room that was voting around the time Prop 1 came about. It gave the tribes gambling. The state, which you seem to say is, which I'm getting from you, is undefeatable, came across and said that tribes could not have gambling. It was the state attorney general, Larry Eckelbach, and the legislature and the governor held an emergency constitutional meeting to change the rules on class 3 gaming. Okay? Class 3 gaming was legal before the tribes started doing it. There was a man in Boise that had a bar that had that. We just went along because it was already on the books. Larry Eckelbach and the governor at the time passed a new constitution, which it was illegal, but they changed it and changed the law to no class 3 gaming. Okay, so you're saying the state is undefeatable. It is defeatable. You guys all supported class 1 gaming. It came across. Okay, what we have an initiative process here in the state of Idaho. Now you're telling me that all the states it's not defeatable. I think it is, and I take exception to your I guess your approach to this, that it's not debatable, it is debatable. You know, our tribal gaming is proof of that. You know, and we're the minority in this state. Mm-hmm. And so I think this, you know, I think that whole attitude that comes from that, and it was a positive attitude among the tribes. We went forward with a positive attitude, you know, this is what we're going to do. Well, I think, I'm not appreciative of the negativity that's coming across.